Welcome to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm so glad you're here tonight. Tuesday Evenings, I think most of you are aware, is a weekly program. It started last week and it runs through November 18th this fall. Next week, Jenny Jaski, curator of the Artist Institute at Hunter College in New York, is going to be here. Her talk, she describes it as underscoring the importance of time for curatorial practice today, and how durational modes of engagement can provoke new ways of seeing and being with art. As she presents, in the title of the presentation is Spending Time with the Artist Institute, New York. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Artist Institute, but it is amazing. I came across it on a visit to New York, I think, last spring, and I recommend that you look into it before you come next week, because I know you're coming back, right? Tonight, I'm happy to introduce an artist whose thinking and making truly inspires me. Alan McCollum grew up in Los Angeles, but he has lived and pursued his career as an artist in New York since the mid-1970s. In the early 70s in California, his career was launched with shows such as 24 Young Los Angeles Artists at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art and Los Angeles 72 at Sidney Janis Gallery in New York. In 1975, his work was included in Marcia Tucker's biennial exhibition at the Whitney, and later that year, he moved to New York, where he's lived since. Alan McCollum, as I'm sure most of you know, is represented by a collection of 200 plaster surrogates, 1982, 83 through 85, in the museum's current exhibition, Urban Theater, New York Art in the 1980s. It was in 1978 that Alan became known for his series Surrogate Paintings, which were shown in solo shows throughout New York, including Artist Space. And I mention that one because it was a particular import during that era as well. In 1980, Alan had his first solo exhibition in Europe at Yvonne Lambert Gallery in Paris, which must have been the beginning of Europe's love affair with the work of Alan McCollum. Because in looking at the long and impressive CV that I received from Alan, there's great indication that he must have become a household name in Europe with all of the retrospectives throughout France, Germany, in London, Sweden, Spain, and the Netherlands. In the States, he began showing with Marion Goodman Gallery in 1980, where he introduced plaster surrogates in a large solo exhibition in 1983. In 1985, Alan's work was again chosen for the Whitney Biennial, titled Americana, and this biennial was curated by Group Material, a collaborative which came to prominence in 1980. Again, a significant contribution to that era. Alan has shown and collaborated with many of the great artists throughout his to-date 40-year career, since it is still strong and going, including Richard Prince, Saul LeWitt, Andrea Fraser, Matt Mullican, Laurie Simmons, and Andrea Zeidel. He has produced public art projects in the United States and in Europe, and his work is held in over 60 of the most important museum collections. In addition to solo exhibitions such as Perfect Couples that opened this month at his New York gallery, Friedrich Petzl in New York, Alan's work has been included in significant group shows, as mentioned, but also including the 1988 and the 2013 Venice Biennale, the 1990 Sydney Biennale, 1991 Carnegie International, an exhibition titled A Forest of Signs, Art in the Crisis of Representation, that was at the MoCA in Los Angeles in 1989, Allegories of Modernism at MoMA in 1992, Objects of Desire, The Modern Still Life at MoMA in 1996, Singular Form, Sometimes Repeated, Art from 1951 to the Present at the Guggenheim in New York, and another exhibition focusing on the 80s, This Will Have Been, Art, Love, and Politics, that opened at the ICA Boston last year. Allen's work invites commentary, and a number of interesting writers have published text on it, including Rosalind Cross, Craig Owens, Hal Foster, Lynn Cook, Thomas Lawson, and Helen Molesworth, also Susie Gablick, and Nicholas Borio. Allen's love for art and for ideas can also be found in his own writing and interviews with fellow artists. And in addition to the intelligence evident in his work, it is Allen's insatiable pursuit of discourse and collaborative spirit evident in all aspects of his career that has me so excited about tonight's presentation. So without further delay, please join me in welcoming Allen McCollum.
Sorry. Oh, thank you for your introduction. So now everybody knows everything they need to know, so I could just, you know. So anyway, I apologize in advance for probably talking too long. And if you're only used to being here for an hour, don't worry about it. Just leave if you have to. I'm not going to feel hurt or anything. Okay, I'm going to, instead of just talking about the work that's in the exhibition here, I'm going to go back to 1969 and start talking about how my work transitioned from one step to the next, to the next, to the next, all the way up until this year, or last year, or something like that. So I'm going to try to cover almost 50 years in one talk. Looking at each series. Let me start with some of my earliest work. This was a series I called Constructed Paintings, and I started them in like 1968, 69. And what I was most interested in when I was doing this was the idea of creating a painting that didn't start out as a rectangle that I put something in, but started out as all these little pieces that I glued together, and then once they were large, they became a rectangle. So I think in those days, I hadn't gone to art school, so mostly what I knew was from reading magazines and meeting people. So I always look back and think, this was like I was imitating Frank Stella and Stein painters all at the same time, you know, so it was kind of a formalist but abstract, and so these were made with strips of canvas that were 2 inches high that I would I'd say take a 6-foot roll of canvas and then add another foot 2-inch high, and then go back and start again with the 4-inch piece of canvas, and then go with whatever was left. And I can't explain it very well, but what it did was, it was like knitting or weaving, where a pattern developed as you went ahead. So there were a number of different patterns that produced themselves as I glued the things together. So there's no backing on this. They're just pieces of cloth glued together with boat caulking. And they're not glued onto anything. That was because I was sort of exploring the idea of what a painting was as an object, which was very common back in those days. So I did a lot of different versions of these constructed paintings. And one of the things about this series, or that period of my life, and which went on for quite a while, was that I figured, since I hadn't gone to art school, that if I tried to learn about art in the art school manner, I was going to get really confused. It would take too long, but I wanted to be an artist now. So I avoided going into art stores and trying to figure out how to use paint or clay or, you know, paper and ink or whatever, you know. So I would come up with, so this, the cloth I bought at, you know, was bought at a place where they sell stuff to make sails for boats, and then the dye was just writ dye bought in a supermarket, which of course faded over the years, but I wasn't smart enough to figure it out. And boat caulking was just something you'd buy. I grew up near the coast in Los Angeles, so boat making was a typical thing. So I was avoiding using art materials. It was one of the things going on. I wasn't the only one in Los Angeles avoiding using art materials. There were people working in plastic and glass and polyester resin and stuff. So I was influenced by all that too. This was sewed together, strips. My girlfriend sewed it for me. Now this is this developed into a series of much larger works that were made out of squares. So what I did, would do was cut out hundreds of squares of raw canvas and then take a broom or something and make, just cut, color half of it, some of them gray, some of them red, and then some of them stained, or some of them varnished and some of them not varnished. So you would wind up making just by putting square after square after square after square and thinking in your head, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3. Well, you know, you just, like a systematic production of a painting, there, it had no backing, just like the other. So that's me back then putting one together without, I mean, just organizing it on the floor. And that's how it looked if you got up close. So it was an attempt to come up with something that wound up being a painting but didn't start off being a rectangle, you know, but it became a rectangle after a while. I was trying to reverse everything and make myself think about what an artwork, what a painting was. Using a similar logic, I invented a system where, let's see if I have the picture. Yeah. I designed a system that I took to the printers and had it printed out on paper, not on art printers, but just one of those stores where you print yourself or whatever, and on archival paper. We printed out these 16 different shapes at different sizes, and so then what happened was that I would glue them together. I would paint them. Or I would use ink and do them with ink, or I would use watercolor and do it with the watercolor, or I always use pencil. So what I was basically designing was a kit in my mind, like a system that you could produce drawings, watercolors, paints, paintings, and ink drawings. And so the idea of a kit, one friend called these fake paintings, which I kind of liked. Although I hadn't thought of that term myself, and I wasn't sure if it was meant as a compliment. But I just want to mention, there's some people here are probably old enough to know who John Nagy was. He would teach you how to do paintings on TV. I don't know if I have a picture of his kits, but anyway, that he was my uncle. So I sort of learned from him the idea of a kit. He had paints, learn to draw, learn to paint, learn to sculpt, learn to do this, learn to do that. And the idea of making a kit was very kind of weirdly industrial. And my work, starting even at the very beginning, was kind of industrial almost, like mass producing or coming up with systems that kept making things. But I wanted to make things that always be different. It finally led me to come up with the idea of making a sign that stood for a painting. And as that friend had said, making fake paintings. But I decided I wanted to start thinking anthropologically about what a painting was. This led me into holes. Forever I've been thinking about collectibles. What we collect, why do we collect this or that, or how collecting things has a meaning in our lives. And I wanted to think about paintings in that way. Not like, you know, books might tell you to look in and see beyond like a wonderful window into heaven or something like that. And I wanted to think more like, I remember I had this job working at a sweeping floors in a building. I was a janitor working at night. And I would look out the windows. It was like on the 13th floor. And I would see little rectangles on the wall in different buildings in New York. You know, little. And I'd know they were paintings or drawings or framed artwork. But I wondered, well, how do I know that? Because anthropologically, I belong to this culture and I know what they would be. But I didn't know what it was a painting of. I just knew it was a painting. That was the kind of thing I was trying to do. So I did some shows that just involved what I thought of as signs for a painting. But what happened, you know, like you have a tooth for a sign for what a dentist does, or, you know, a shoe if you're making shoes, you know, hanging out in front of your door if you run a shop. I was thinking, what would a painter hang out? And, well, probably a palette, but I came up with the idea of a sign for a painting. But once I would install these shows, they became like stage sets of a gallery. And I don't think I had fully expected that until I did it. So you would walk into this gallery and you would see these. So that's how I experienced it, was that the viewers became like actors walking around on a stage set. Well, I don't think other people saw it that way as much as I wanted them to. They sort of said, oh, he's a monochrome painter, a monochrome. So in order to try to eliminate that feeling of a monochrome painter having beautiful paintings, you know, whatever, I started making huge quantities of them so that it would be like like installation art, or I don't know if we would have called it back then, but it was like an installation that in itself became a symbol for what you might see on a wall in a museum or a gallery. I never wanted to make them all alike. So every one of these, for instance, is a different size and a different color. So I was always clearly interested in industrial mass production, or what we call that, you know, producing in large quantities, but at the same time, our desire for the unique thing, and we create a whole system where things are really unique, partially unique, only a little bit unique, and then the same, and then really the same, and like everybody's got one, you know. So it was like a view of the class system of objects, but projected onto objects and things. Like wealthy people own the fabulous paintings, and poor people buy postcards, you know. And so that was all in my head. I came from a working class, not rich family. And at a certain point, I started giving them. Oh, I know what I was going to say. Yeah, this people still saw these as monochromes, and that wasn't what I was trying to do. So I started making the frames and putting black in the middle, so that the frame was a different color, the mat was a different color, and what was inside the mat was just sort of blank, as if it was just a signifier. And they were made from wood, and they took a lot of time to make. Just the idea, by the way, of looking out the window and seeing paintings in other people's windows and not being able to tell what they are. I tried to duplicate that feeling by taking my pictures of my own surrogate paintings, they were called, and then reprinting them and re-photographing, reprinting and re-photographing and reprinting. And this was way before Photoshop or anything like that. So I did a series of works where the artworks became like a Martian anthropologist looking at why those people live in cubes and why do they put flat things on their cubic walls and what's that all about. And so I wanted to give that impression. So this one is almost like a, you know, UFO picture. That was the type of feeling I was trying to gain. Sometimes even in museums, like there's one in the background. This was at the Guggenheim, and that somebody was in the newspaper. So I got very interested in the idea of the painting as a prop in the background, thinking of it that way, not as a window into beautiful design and perfection. It was more of a conceptual way of looking at paintings. In 1980, so therefore somewhere around, I started making fake photographs. Now these look like snapshots, and they're very shiny. But what they are is a piece of paper, all different sizes that I made, and then I would paint or use ink or watercolor or felt markers to make a blackish rectangle and then put adhesive laminate over it and then cut it out so it had a white border and then stack them up so they looked like a collection of photographs. So in this case, I was becoming more interested in what people collect at home, not just what museums collect or wealthy people or that kind of a thing. I started thinking about collectibles in general. How do I... Uh-oh. How do I make it go? Oh, I see. Okay. There it is. It disappears when I'm not using it. And this led me to, at the same period, I was doing photographs of, I would keep my camera in front of my television, black and white, and whenever I'd see something that looked like one of my surrogate paintings in the background, I would take a picture. And you'd be surprised how many times you'll see these things if you watch closely on a TV. So part of this was... part of this was to accentuate the idea that paintings are meant to be in the background, that we don't, that as an artist you are making things that are always in the background of human activity, and that's something I, instead of thinking that paintings are supposed to be, monuments to taste or something, but they're just, in reality, they're just in the background, something you hung over your bed or your couch or whatever. But this series also led, this was not an art series. This was what I called a series of supplements. So what would happen is, I don't think I have a picture of it, but I would have a show of what ultimately became plaster surrogates. I started making them out of plaster. And then I would have these pictures in the hanging in the office so that I was trying to put a spin on the surrogate plaster surrogates themselves so that you would look at all these pictures, there'd be like 12 of them on the wall or something, and you'd see them always in the background, always black. And then you'd look at the show and you'd think, it would affect the way you looked at it. And this became a very interesting thing to me, that we look at art with supplements, whether they're in front of us or not. Like, we go look at an art exhibit and it's... The meaning comes to us because of other art we've seen, or what we've read, or the ads we've seen in on the artwork, or the press release that we've read, or a book we've read about the art, or whatever. It's never like the real true experience. It's always backed up by what I called supplements. So I started making art. I made a lot of series that had supplements that weren't the artworks, but helped you help me have the viewers put a spin on what they were looking at so they would see it differently. And I was especially influenced, the way Marlboro cigarettes or a car company puts beautiful pictures of the car riding in, under the waterfall or whatever, down the desert, just to make you look at the car differently. And I could never look at a pack of Marlboro cigarettes without picturing all the ads I've seen for Marlboro cigarettes. So there was a little bit of that. In my mind, I was thinking, that's the same as I can't look at a painting at the Museum of Modern Art. If I've already seen a million images of it in art history books and so forth, I can't really see it and forget all the art history books that I've read and how important the artist is, that kind of a thing. This was especially... Let me see, how can I show this? I want to show now to make sense. All right, this was my first show of plaster surrogates. I started casting them in plaster. And there were 20 different sizes, and that's what we have out here in the museum. 200 of these. This show, the first show I ever did, had around 500. And I didn't want people to think I was just, making multiples. So I came up with a whole, a bunch of colors. What do you call it? A palette of colors, I don't know. And different sizes, 20 different sizes, and five different frame face sizes. And then, so there were no two alike, even though the gallery might have been filled with hundreds and hundreds of them, there were no two alike. And then I also decided to make selling a part of the work. So the four smallest were $100, and the next four biggest were $200, and then the biggest ones were $500, and you could buy one. And it really didn't work out economically for me or the gallery, because major collectors would come in and say, "Oh, I'll take this one," and it was $100, you know, and then, or they'd get so confused trying to pick one, they gave up. But anyway, I was also interested in, as you tell from the previous things I showed, I'm interested in photographs of art. So I started making ones with gray frames. This is not a black and white photograph. I did a couple of shows that were meant to look like installation views of one of the other shows. So it was like walking into a photograph. So first you'd be walking into a stage, and then you'd be walking into a photograph, and you were the actor, as you were the actor playing the viewer. So I didn't give them a different title, but the gray ones were clearly, in my mind, meant to imitate the walking into a black and white photograph. Then I started mostly using the big ones, and this is one of the molds that I made for the plaster surrogates. This is a picture Louise Lawler, my friend, took of me working on them. This is back in 82, I guess. Oh, I know why this is, because I was in a show in a museum at the Moderna Museet in Stockholm, and the education curator invited children to look at my work and then make their versions of my, and I remember they sent me this slide and I was just floored, because I thought, oh my God, everyone been saying my work was about the death of painting, when I said it certainly is not about the death of painting, because the supplements, what were they called, the supplements? Snapshots, surrogates on location. The supplements led me into also thinking about how, when you see a painting in the background on television, it's often, you can see that it's an image, but you can't tell what the image is. And so I started doing a series of works like that. I take a picture off the TV, then blow up the image and put it in a frame, and I'd have a show, you know, like that one, of those images, but no one knew what they were. So in a way, I was trying to make work about the desire to see an image, like if you go visit somebody and they say, "Let me get you a drink and I'll hang your coat up," and then they walk out of the room and then you walk around and look at the pictures on the wall. I just thought, yeah, that's what we do. We have a desire to look at an image, but in this case, there wouldn't be one. But if you turned it over and looked at the back, you'd see the image from the television that it came from. And I did. I'm actually doing a series of prints right now based on this, except every one came from the Twilight Zone from the 50s. And then I started making them larger also. Right during that same period, my friend Louise Lawler and I collaborated on the project. I was invited to do a show. I said, "Louise, let's do something together." And this was a show that was basically just about a show. Or a presentation that was just about presentation, or a display that was just about display. So what you're seeing, I guess I don't have a better picture, but what you're seeing is a lot of little display bases sitting on display bases with dramatic lighting and the price projected on the wall so it was just about the drama of presenting. But what you were presenting was something you'd use to present something else. It wasn't really a complete, So that was a project I liked very much. Louise Lawler and I did a couple of projects together. This one was called The Fixed Interval. And we made them out of plaster, and then we made them out of brass. And these were about this big. They were just little symbols. What do you call it when you're a graphic designer and you put a little thing at the bottom of the page? What are those things called? What are they?
Is it the copyright sign?
What?
copyright? Is it copyright?
No, it's like a little flower or a little...
An insignia? An insignia?
No, there's a special name if you're in graphics. Anyway.
It's called a dingbat.
Dingbats, yes, they're called dingbats. Thank you. So these... We were having a two-person show together in France, and our work is very dissimilar in many ways. I mean, our thoughts are not, but our work itself. And there was something awkward about putting her work and my work, and then her work and my work, so because it looked weird. And so we decided to make a symbol that could go in between the works. And so that's what these were originally. And then we started thinking, well, what does this mean? And we came up with two thoughts about what it meant. It was about a missing artwork. And our thought was, I would never do anything that looked like her work, and she would never do anything that looked like my work. So think of all the thousands of artworks that aren't made. Because an artist always tries to be original and not make art like somebody else. But there's a million things that could have been done in between, but this artist doesn't want to look like that artist, and that artist doesn't look like that artist. So it was like a memorial to all the absent artworks that that could have been made but weren't. And then it also was used as a replacement, and we gave some to museums. If you send a work out to the people who clean artworks, or if you lend an artwork from the museum to another museum, they often put a little tag there that says, out for cleaning or something, or restoration. So we used those objects also that they could be used when a painting was sent to be cleaned or lent to somebody else. And then until it came back, you could put one of these. Anyway, that was our... We thought that was pretty funny. This is odd. I'm not be able to find the... How I can... Oh, okay, there it is. No, then it disappears. It's so weird. The idea of doing sculpture probably, came doing a sculpture of a common collectible, aside from these collaborations I was doing, was kind of like the plaster surrogates led me into the idea of making kind of a symbol that stood for a three-dimensional collectible. And this one actually used the same paints I'd been using on the surrogates. But the vase is solid. So I was trying to think, like, what is it that hundreds and thousands of people collect? And you see it on TV, you see it on every play. There's always kind of a vase somewhere on the mantelpiece and often they're Asian vases, and I don't know what that's supposed to symbolize, that you're interested in different cultures, or that you've been around the world, or that you have the money to pay for an antique, or you buy one that only costs $10 and it just makes it kind of look like you love other cultures, or I don't know why the Asian vase is, but I was especially excited when I go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art or different museums like the Victoria and Albert in London. I mean, they'll have hundreds of vases, and it's something that people collect, but the value can be close to, $5 up to millions, I suppose. So it was kind of a symbol of a symbol of what people collect. That's the idea of making a vase. And I ultimately, moved on to, just to see, like on TV. The Asian vase is something you see everywhere. What was this? I forget. This was a famous Michael Jackson's apartment or something like that. And so they're common. They're a common collectible. So I started making them out of plaster, but they're filled with plaster. They're not hollow. You can't take the vase off. It's just a solid thing. And then putting them into collections of five. And so that was a series called Perfect Vehicles that I made, a large number of them, and there's only ever been two sizes made, but I would do shows like this called Perfect Vehicles, and they were like symbols of symbols in my mind. These are symbolic objects. that people collect. Another collaboration done right during the same period was with the artist Laurie Simmons. And what we did was, Laurie often did these projects where she would make little dolls and photograph them. And you know that movie Tiny Furniture by Lena Dunham? I mean, this is Lena Dunham's mother. So she and I got this idea together that combining her idea of using dolls to my idea of going into something that where you couldn't tell what it was anymore, like a perpetual photograph. So we kind of tried to combine this, and we went out and started buying these, like they have for train toy trains, like they have little tiny figures that you would put alongside the tiny toy trains. Let me see if I have a picture. They're that tiny, and they're cast and hand-painted, but they're mass-produced, and you can buy them in toy stores, but when you look up close, they're each unique. And this, to me, was a philosophical point I wanted to make, that why do we decide things are all alike and come up with stereotypes? You know, all men only want one thing, and all women are this, or whatever, you know, or talk about religions or people from other countries. So the idea of stereotyping had started to interest me because, well, I'll get to that later. So we took these to the hospital. A friend of a friend knew a woman who did the photography in the cancer society, in the cancer section, where she would take pictures of tiny little cellular things for the doctors to look at. And so she agreed to come in on work on Sunday, and so we took close-ups of all these little tiny, teeny figures. And how... and, of course, I have to admit that this was during a period when German artists were so hot in New York, so we were making fun. Part of what we were doing it was making fun of the Dusseldorf School of Photography and the Neo-Expressionists at the same time. So, this interest in uniqueness and quantity and mass production or quantity production really came to a head with this series that I did. These are called individual works, and I was influenced by the kind of collectible you buy, say, at Tiffany's or Steubenglass. And I was and I was working at the Cooper Hewitt Museum at the time as a registration technician, where you do condition reports on everything that comes in. And so we had these Fabergé eggs come through. And I remember looking at and having to look at them and write down when and they were hugely expensive Fabergé eggs because they're covered with jewelry and everything. And I started feeling, what value do these have outside of being really expensive? And that stuck with me. I mean, not that they weren't beautiful to look at and so forth, but all Ukrainian eggs are beautiful to look at, even if they're just made, you know, by your daughter at the kitchen table. So I felt kind of interested but a little bit grouchy about the fact that somebody would make a tiny little object that only had value because it was really expensive, you know. So I tried to combine that idea with the idea of producing things in large quantities, but each unique. So this series was called Individual Works. I've made so far over 30,000 of these little objects, and no two are alike. There's three different colors, but even if they were all the same colors, they're not alike. They're each unique. And I even had a photographer friend come and photograph them as if they were in the Steubenglass catalog, because we had a Steubenglass catalog that we would imitate how they did this. But what really got to me during this period was, why do we manufacture things that are all alike? Well, okay, it's a little bit cheaper, maybe, if you have a big machine that does this. But there are other reasons. There are philosophical reasons, because when I figured this project out to make over 30,000, I was originally making them for, they cost me $4 each to make the first 10,000. When I added all up, having my hiring assistants and hiring a fellow to help, Kenny Goldsmith, to help do all the casting. And I'm thinking, well, if they're only $5 each, you could multiply that by six and they'd only be $30 each, and there would be a profit if you sold them in a souvenir store. What's the reason for not? I was thinking the math for doing this could have been figured out if you were a caveman. I mean, it was so simple. It was A plus B, A plus C, A plus A, A plus D, and then B plus B, B plus C, B plus. It's just like, I came up with, I can't remember how many, I think a couple hundred shapes parts. Well, I'll show you how it worked. I found all these little things in supermarkets and drugstores and on the street, and my girlfriend's thing that she had her lens in, or just things around the home, just normal everyday things, and made all these little parts, which I then glued to circles, to 2-inch plexi circles, made molds, and then all these books on how to combine them so that you never repeat it. And I swear, knitting a scarf is more complicated than what I was doing. So one of the questions I was just asking was, why don't people do this? Why aren't people applying systems to making unique objects instead of always applying systems to making all objects the same? And I started to associate that with the class system. The more unique and handmade a thing is, the more expensive it is, and the more, if there's thousands of things all alike, then the less expensive they are. But there's a certain logic to it in terms of manufacturing, but there's also a belief in a certain aristocratic class system that's at work too. So I was being, like I say, anthropological and trying to figure out how people codify and stereotype and stuff like that, which started to appear in my work in many different ways. This series was, for instance, based on the idea of heraldry. I had been to Switzerland or somewhere, I think it was Switzerland, and every county had its own symbol. Like in Scotland, every family has their heraldic. There's a MacCullum symbol for, and in Ireland and in the Middle Ages, they made heraldry involved. Every family had a symbol. Towns had a symbol. Armies had symbols. Countries had symbols. Religion had symbols. It's a great way to get people all feel like they're one. Like if they're all praying down to the cross or some religious symbol, then they all feel like they're together or saluting the flag or whatever. But I thought, well, you could also have a symbol that represented every person on the planet as an image. And we have it in numbers, like phone numbers. I love it that everybody has their own phone number. And there's, 8 billion people on the planet? And I don't know if they all have phones, but no two phone numbers are alike. And so, I love that. Or Social Security number. But it isn't the same as looking at something and thinking, oh, that's really nice to look at. It's just not the same. So I came up with a system that could theoretically produce millions of new unique shapes. And I made stencils. I designed stencils. I had to get them made by a stencil maker. I remember I had to go out to Tucson, because I was the only company that did custom-made stencils in those days. Well, now it's much simpler with computer lasers and stuff. And they did use computers out there, too, but it was uncommon. And so they made, I think, 100 different stencils for me that you started combining and could make unique shapes and then fill them in with a black pencil. So And booklets also to show which ones to make, which ones you've already made, and stuff like that. So that was that project. It's clearly related to the surrogates, and most of my projects are about large quantities of things. One of the things in making copies, because one of the things I was doing was making molds and making objects, was that if you make a copy, it never has the feeling of being old. And one of the things people like to do with their heirlooms and their family collectibles and their paintings at the Metropolitan, and they like to see age. They like to say, oh my God, that was painted in, you know, that vase was made in, before, you know, 200 years before Christ, and oh, look at that painting from 1500s and all that. So it worried me that since I was into making molds and making copies, that I would never have that feeling of something being old that we like to look for, until I started thinking about fossils, because fossils are already copies. The bone has completely disappeared, but it's been filled with minerals that it rebuilds itself, out of, stone. So I've been thinking about that since, I don't know, the early 80s, but I didn't have any access to fossils. But then the Carnegie Museum of Art invited me, the curator there invited me to do a project, and in the same building is the Carnegie Museum of Natural History, and there's like a door you walk, you're looking at contemporary art, you walk through a door and you're looking at dinosaur skeletons. Is there a pro-dinosaur person in the audience?
What do you mean pro? I like dinosaurs.
There's a fellow that walked by me early. He has pro-dinosaur on his shirt. I have no idea why, but I thought... So I made a deal with the museum. The museum art museum curator introduced me to the director of the Natural History Museum, and she was an expert on mouse fossils, which I didn't find that interesting, because they weren't big and dramatic. But then I met people who were involved in dinosaur fossils and stuff, and so they let me make, they made casts of 15 different dinosaur legs or arms or whatever, and I came up with 75 colors. And so there were no two alike. We made 750 of these darn things. I still have 735 of them. And that's, in case you don't understand, that artists have storage problems. A similar project that I was doing just about the same time was another idea of the past. The past plaster cast from the Pompeii Vesuvius explosion that suffocated a lot of people with the ashes, and so an art deal, a gallerist from Naples invited me to do a show in Naples, and I said, can you get me permission to do a copy of one of the casts of something from Pompeii? And he spent months and months writing letters to the government, and nobody would say yes, he could. So then he found a museum in modern-day Pompeii that had a copy of the original copy of the original copy. And because it started out, the copy was a mold that in the 1800s they filled with plaster, and then they had a copy from the mold, and then they made another copy from that to go into a museum in present-day Pompeii, which is miles from the actual Pompeii, so the ancient Pompeii. So they gave us permission, finally, after months and months of attempting. So I made about 100 of these, which also represent the past. And I think what was interesting to me was, well, one thing is that if it's already a copy, why aren't they making hundreds of them? Why can't you buy one at the local souvenir store? But, you know, they want to maintain, I guess, the specialness of coming to visit Pompeii. But on the other hand, if it's already a copy, what difference does it make if you make more copies? So it was just the way my mind was working. And they allowed me to do it as long as I called it an art project. If I were to try to sell it to a museum, so they would sue me, you know, because they weren't... And the same with the dinosaur bones. They don't... part of the ways dinosaur natural history museums make money is selling casts of the bones, because most dinosaur skeletons we see are made up of bones from different museums that people have cast, and they put them together, because there's only, like, I think, two, if that, total Tyrannosaurus skeletons. Every Tyrannosaurus skeleton you see is made up from things that belong to different museums, and they buy them and put them together. So maybe there's only six bones that are real, and they're not even real. They're copies from the fossils. So anyway, it's complicated. But it helped me. But I was already thinking about copies and quantity production and why we do this and why we don't do that when we could. And I also like the way that even if you copy it, in 90 AD or something, it's like 2,000 years later, you still feel sad when you look at it. That had an effect on me too, that a simple emotion like feeling sorry for a dog that was suffocated can continue to work through copies of copies of copies. So I was kind of, tracing how emotions can, be copied and go through time. Okay, this is another project, and I want to talk a little more about the whole idea of making fossils. This was a series I did with just dinosaur footprints. But they come from a small town in Price, Utah, which I went out to Utah to look at the colors to know what colors to use for the dinosaur bones, because all of them came from the Utah area. So I was out in Utah, and this is some of his memorabilia from the Carnegie. This is the Carnegie Museum. This brontosaurus, by the way, not the brontosaurus, what's it called? The Diplodocus. Carnegie's hired a crew to go look for the biggest dinosaur that anyone have ever found. See, so he paid for this. And they found this big, huge Diplodocus in Utah. And he had them bring the whole thing back to Pittsburgh. But before he put it together, he made casts of every bone and donated copies of his famous dinosaur to, I think, 8 different museums. And somebody still has the molds, and they're still making casts of it for museums. So it was like this image is not a copy, but God, this is so weird that it doesn't. Okay, well, that's the copy at the British Museum. So I was wrong. No, that's not their copy. Their copy is here at the Carnegie. But then here's a copy at the... I mean, that's not a copy. It's the original fossils that are a copy. Then this is a copy at the British Museum. This is a copy at the... in Madrid. Berlin. So he made copies of it and gave it to all these different museums. I don't know. That was very interesting to me that he actually did that. But while I was out there, I went out there to look at the Dinosaur National Monument, which was what they made after the Carnegie dig site. They turned it into a national monument. And so I was out there looking at what they have now. There must be some other way to do this. And I was staying in Vernal, Utah. Now, Vernal, Utah, I had never been there before, but that was the city that was near the Dinosaur National Monument. And they have basically defined their city in such a way that tourists go through it. So you have gas stations called the Dinosaur Gas Station, the Dinosaur Motel, and they have these big images of dinosaurs surrounding their town. And this is what was interesting to me, and I always tell this story when I do a talk. I checked into a motel. It may have even been called the Dinosaur Motel. I don't remember. And she said, "Oh, you're from New York?" Because I showed her my credit card and stuff. And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, what are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I'm doing a project with the Carnegie Museum, and I wanted to see, where they came from, where the bones came from, and all that." And she looked at me in a very much annoyed and said, "Well, we don't think much of Carnegie out here." And then I said, "Why?" And she said, "Well, came out here before the railroads even came out here and discovered the dinosaur bones that we didn't even know about and stole our heritage and moved everything back to Pittsburgh and completely stole our heritage. So I thought about that later. I thought, well, I'm sorry, I told her, you know, and then I was thinking, why does she think dinosaurs are her heritage? So I grew up in California. I grew up, so that's part of the Southwest. I and my parents, my mother's family was all from Texas. We weren't, none of us were from that. Well, my father was from New York, but all my mother's side were from in the middle of, you know, were in areas where pioneers created new towns. Like my mother grew up in Crockett, which was only named Crockett because supposedly Davy Crockett slept under one of the trees once. And so a lot of the towns in the Southwest and the are named after goofy things like that, you know, named after a rock formation or named after an animal or something that has to do. They're not named after the king or the queen of or the aristocracy of your neighbors, you know. It's so they had Vernal had I wonder where Vernal came from. But they had identified with dinosaurs. So dinosaurs were part of their heritage so in their minds. And so this really, because I was from the Southwest myself, California, that really struck me as interesting how people not only find meaning in the objects they collect and heirlooms from their family and so forth, but they also see geological things around them that they sometimes name their towns after or they identify with. So I did a number of projects based on how towns, the symbols townspeople use to represent themselves in some way. Now, while I was driving through Utah, God, I hate the time it takes to do this. I came into the Carbon County, and there's a town there called Price. And the county is mostly founded on coal mines. And that's why it's called Carbon County. And there's a museum there that only started in the 60s, of a prehistoric museum where instead of seeing all of their dinosaur bones going to Salt Lake City or someplace else, they started their own museum to show their own artifacts from the area. So, they also showed Native American things, which they also, you know, prehistoric Native American items and stuff. If I don't know why that counts as prehistoric, but I guess it does in terms of the, you know, European. So anyway, I visited the museum. It was a beautiful little museum, and one of the things I had never heard of was. Not, I'd seen dinosaur tracks, but I'd never seen dinosaur track casts. So what happens when the dinosaurs will walk through? God darn! How are you supposed to do this? So they had this display, and this was dinosaur track casts. Well, they didn't make the casts. What happened was they were made by nature, and what happens is the dinosaur will walk through mud, or I don't know what you call it, and then, no, it's not mud, it's, I forget, silt, or if I forget. Anyway, silt fills their footprints and then builds up into sandstone, and it actually makes a cast of the footprint, and what's underneath it becomes coal. What is it that becomes coal? I forget. And so that when the coal miners go to dig out a coal mine, they look up in certain areas of Carbon County, they look up and see dinosaur track casts coming down from the ceiling. And it's a very local thing. So you see there's a little, if you want to know how it works. And so they'll look up to the ceiling, and there's dinosaur footprints all across the ceiling, and sometimes they fall and hurt people. So one of the things they do is take them down for safety, but they also take them down to collect, and they put them in their front yards or in their dining room or whatever, dinosaur track casts. So, and they donate them to the local museum. I mean, really, in the name of our great-grandfather who was a coal miner and things like that. And one of the One of the preparators at the museum had been a coal miner, had worked for coal miners, and he had chopped down a number of these things. But they had a collection of over 40, 44, I think, at the time. They probably have more now, but 44 track casts that were given in memory and donated by the local people. So we made a deal where they made molds of all 40, every one of their track casts, and then I, because they were already copies, and I took the copies to New York, and took the molds to New York, and we remade production molds where you could make many more, and I did some exhibits where they were painted in different colors, very decorative, and. But this was the first show that I had supplements that were actually educational. there were 21 handouts that you could take that told you what about the history of dinosaur footprints and their casts. And it's actually online if you wanted to look. If you wanted to look it up, they're called reprints, which is kind of a joke. And, but you can download them as PDF files if you're teaching your class about dinosaur tracks or something like that. And there's like 21 of them. So anyway, that was that project. But it was really fun because I got to meet people I wouldn't normally meet and taken on tours of the desert, that I wouldn't have known how to do myself. Darn. I guess I just have to do this every time. Okay. Then the idea of community projects, quantity production, geological oddities kind of crowded my mind for some time. And I was invited to make a proposal to a science museum in Tampa, Florida. And I sometimes took vacations in Sarasota, Florida. So I was familiar with driving around in Florida a little bit. And one of the things I had discovered while I was on vacation in Florida was this museum I used to go have my fortune told in this town, which is all filled with spiritualists. That then there was this little museum I would drive through on the way to Casadega to have my fortune told, called the Gillespie Museum of Minerals, and they had on display what they called a sand spike. Now, the label said these sand spikes are caused when lightning hits sand, and it goes into the sand, and it melts the sand, but then it immediately solidifies, so you have an object made out of sand that was caused by lightning. And I thought that was really interesting because the objects clearly looked like they were made by hand. They looked like some sort of surrealist, penis or something. So I started to do research on them and found out that they were completely wrong in what it was. It was a sand spike caused. It was a water concretion, sand concretion. It had nothing to do with lightning. And so I discovered the history of sand concretions and fulgurites. That's fulgurite. That's a fulgurite. That's the world's longest fulgurite. And I found an article in Science magazine about a fellow who collected long, and he's the one who collected this. And it's much bigger, much smaller than you think from that picture. It makes it look like it's hundreds of feet long, but I think it was 17 feet or something. And so when I was invited to do the project with this science museum in Tampa, I said, can we contact this guy in Gainesville who works at, he works on a place where they study lightning. And so they said, okay. So I visited the Lightning Center in Stark, Florida. And I became friends with the director, and we collaborated, and the museum paid a certain amount of money. And we stood there for 6 weeks, sending up rockets occasionally, whenever there was a cloud that come over that might create lightning, and they could tell it was going to create lightning because they had measurements to measure the electrical or whatever. And then I would push this button, this is the staff, and then they would let me push a button to send up a rocket to trigger the lightning, but it had a wire coming down from the rocket, so when it got up into the clouds, the lightning would come down the wire and go into this bucket of sand that I made, and they let me push the button because I was the artist, and then you... And the rocket would take off, and then it would trigger the light, and it would come right down the wire and go into that bucket. And then, and I had made a receptacle. I had to make a special receptacle. It's usually a fulgurite is hollow at one end, and I thought, well, if we made two metals and it went between two screws, then it would be solid at both ends. And it turned, and they didn't think it would work, but I did, and I was so proud of myself. Because otherwise I couldn't have made a mold of it, you know, if it was a hollow thing. So this was the fulgurite. Ultimately, we made many fulgurites we didn't like and used all different kinds of sand. But we did ultimately come up with the fulgurite. And so I made over 10,000 copies of them, collaborating with a souvenir manufacturer in DeLand, Florida. So it was very Floridian. I mean, lightning, Florida is the lightning capital of North America. So there's more lightning in Florida. So they identify with it. The Tampa Bay Lightnings, for instance. I mean, it's a community thing. And so I got lots of people to help me on this. We made 66 booklets about fulgurites and lightning, which you can also go online and download. It's the largest collection of articles about fulgurites you would ever want to find anywhere. So then we did interviews with the people that help. He's the director of the, electrical, what's he called? The director of electrical studies at Gainsborough. This is the a paleontologist whose hobby was collecting fulgurites, so he helped. This is a mold maker who had a museum in Florida, and he made the molds for us. This is the curator and I, and they're all booklets on all of them. And then this is the photographer who took the picture of and this is the fellow who owned the son of the guy who owned the Sand Creations plant that made the souvenirs. So I got involved with I wanted there to be a community collaboration, which wasn't something I'd really done before. I'd sort of started in Utah when in that town with the dinosaurs, but this one I made a point of trying to involve lots of people. And like, for instance, let's see if I have a picture of that. This fellow, Dan, the paleontologist, he had actually... I just don't get this. How come I can't make it...
Is anybody in the audience?
Huh? Ah! Okay. He had once, before I ever met him, he'd made a model of what it looked like when lightning hit the ground, and he'd had it in his garage. He didn't know what to do with it, and so we were able to make that part of the show. So I was helping them too, and giving money to the experimental site and stuff like that, and they had an exhibit of the whole process of making the fulgurite, so that, you know, it was a museum project, and it's been shown maybe three times since then. This was at the Miami Art Museum. Of all the booklets I had, we made something like 13,000 booklets. There's 66 of them, but we made a quantity of each, and then you can read them. And then there's the hundreds of the thousands of surrogates. Fulgurites. So, all right. So what happens sometimes is two things come together like sisters, like a project. Like that museum had called it a sand spike when it was a fulgurite. But then I also had to learn, well, what is a sand spike? And then I found out that sand spikes, what's called sand spikes, come from a mountain that comes across from Mexico to California. And near Calexico and Mexicali, And if you drive down, it's the only mountain nearby, and it's a very popular mountain in terms of the local people. And at the foot of the mountain, you see, because this all used to be a lake until 900 years ago. It was very recent, and they would form sand concretions in the sand because of the water. And so I found some books and articles and stuff on sand spikes. So I decided to go out there and see if I could collaborate with that community. And nobody invited me. That's when I went out to on myself and found out that, you know, many local, not everybody knew what the sand spikes were, but the local geologists or people that belong to rock clubs, they all knew what they were, and a lot of them had collections of the sand spikes, and they do use, they did use, what do you call, the sand concretions were part of their culture. They would collect them and put them in their living rooms or in their front yards, and even bowling. It was part of the local culture, and there's the other kinds of concretions in other. The shape of the sand spike was unique to that particular mountain. There are some similar elsewhere, but not made of sand. There had been a lot of mysteries about where did the sand spikes come from and why are they all facing in the same direction. And there was even a theory that they were from a foreign planet, or one fellow had a theory, and I wasn't sure if he was joking or not, because I found it on a website that he was thinking maybe there was a whole herd of deer, and somebody scared all the deer, and they all pooped at the same time and ran. But there's many different versions of sand concretions in different shapes. So the shapes really do have to do with where they come from. So it's like a site work to make copies of that. This is the mountain. This is an old picture of the mountain from many years ago. And it's a local landmark. And it was used on... when they were building rivers and the All-American Canal, which brings water to the area, the mountains in the background, they use the mountain in their county seal and badges that you can buy. You see it on plates. So they've named a restaurant after Mount Signal. It's called Mount Signal in Calexico, but in Mexicali it's called El Cerro Centinela, El Cerro Centinela. And there was all this myth about it. I mean, it's where American Indians used to climb up and make smoke to signal to somebody on another mountain 50 miles away some message by sending smoke up. So it had even had a history, a mysterious history. So you can see it's used over and over, mini storage, I don't know, fruit, postcards. So I guess I could show you every one of these if you wanted to see them, because I love looking at them. It's just, this is like a postcard done by a local hotel, first in black and white, then colored again, and then a bird added, also the same picture. That really cracked me up. But anyway, so it was back into that area of what local people find important geologically in order to name. So I bought, I actually bought this photograph. I found on the web. This is a painting by a very well-known Mexican fellow. And I curated a show of artists who did pictures of Mount Signal. That's all this is leading up to. I met that woman. She's great. This woman actually helped me put together the show. This was Andrea Zittel's grandmother. If you know who Andrea Zittel is, she's a California artist. So anyway, but also made a giant mountain. I made made souvenirs of the mountain in quantity. And in the show, I put on a display of, this show was in two places, once in San Diego and once in the Imperial Valley. And there were local souvenirs, local collectors who collected sand spikes, and copies of sand spikes I did. So they were like souvenirs, and I let them be for sale in the local museum gift shop, a giant one. And a lot of the people didn't know what sand spikes were that lived in the very community. And in the museum, the local historical museum, this was the second collaboration I'd ever done with the museum. No, I guess the third, but this was the deepest so far. A lot of the people that worked in the museum, and they all got volunteers, thought these were Native American pestles. And they had them with Native American tools. And I had to tell them, no, no. And then I taught them about their own Mount Signal memorabilia. And then of course, that we realized that many, many people had collections of sand spikes. It's just the people in the museum didn't know it. So that's my sand spike with little instructions of what they are, and little, buy it in a little box for $15 or whatever it was. I don't remember. Now, you can see the connection to modern art, though, if you look, compare my... That's supposed to make you laugh. Okay. So anyway, I mean, these are works by modern contemporary surrealist art. Well, okay. Let's see, what else? And then and involved in that was a website. Which isn't opening. I don't know why. But I had local poems written by local people, stories written by local people, images from that's something else again, a project that never happened. Well, what is... All right, I can't show you the website. Maybe it's something wrong here. Okay, so that was that project, and I'll try to hurry through the rest of them. This was another local project where in Montpellier, France, where I made copies of some old statues that had all deteriorated, and it was a little bit like the fossil thing. And there was a mansion that had been abandoned in the 1800s, and now the city used it for storage of, for tools, you know, but they had these allegorical statues all around them like this, but they had all fallen apart. People had chopped the heads off, the rain had made them erode, and they were just lumps, you know, like that. So I had them make copies of every one. Then we made souvenirs, about over 1,000 souvenirs to give to local people who came to the opening when we did that show with all the colors. So that was another community project. This was about in Sweden. They had a history of their elm trees had lasted way after our Americans' elm trees all disappeared. But only just recently the elm disease had hit Sweden. And so they had to slice, cut off, and it was a... They had to cut them all down, and it was invited to do a project in a forest, because it was a forest, what do you call it, sculpture forest, where they put ask artists to do things in the forest. So I did 12 copies of the tree stump, all different colors. And part of this was inspired by, you know, what's his name who wrote the book The Giving Tree? What's his name? Shel Silverstein, yeah. So that was partly inspired by Shel Silverstein, which I loved that book, The Giving Tree. Then I made a series of objects that addressed or explored the idea of exchange. These were objects that had no meaning unless you gave them to somebody, and they all said thanks. And I did all different versions of those thanks. Another idea of a community was a zip code. I had a show in a gallery in Boston, and I took the zip code of the area that the gallery was in and looked at their mailing list and took everybody from that zip code and took all their first names and then combined them as couples. So That was a different concept of a community. This was a new part of the city of Malmo. And like the drawing series, I made a system for every apartment building that they were in the process of building. And every apartment could have its own symbol. And the building itself had a master symbol. No, that's not why. A master symbol that all the others were derived from, because it was the same at the bottom and top. So my idea was that if you grew up in this was, nobody lived there yet. They were just building these apartment buildings. That if you grew up there, you would start identifying with the symbol when you were a child, and that you might even want to make your clubhouse symbol or your badge, or you or a business might want to use the symbol as their business symbol. So I gave them all floppy disks of all the symbols. Each building manager had that. Another series I did, but I guess I'm talking too long. I was invited to do a show in Kansas City at the Grand Arts, and they gave me $15,000 to do a project. So I said, let's divide it in half. Well, half of that will go to making art objects to where that you can actually sell if you want to. And the other half will go to make things to give away. So I got this company that made to make two topographical maps of Kansas and Missouri, one each. And then I made filled them in and worked on them. And then we made molds from them. And so then when I did the show, these were the so-called artworks. I don't know why I'm calling my own work so-called, but I can't believe I said that. Think what you will. I like to think of them as artworks, but so these were the maps of the state, topographical maps of the state. But we also did I did drawings of every county in both states, and they were like that. So it was kind of. But then the nonprofit, the giveaway thing, was we took the molds and made plaster casts, or actually hydrostone casts of. And dried them all, but didn't. All we did was paint them with a primer. So they were all white and ready to be painted in some other way if you wanted to. And I mailed out something like 250 letters to all the different historical society museums in Missouri and Kansas. I found this book where they listed all of the, you know. So I offering to give away. And I made like they could offering to give away. There was also a website, and I wrote it to all of these regional museums. 120 of them responded. So we made 120 casts, some of Kansas, some of Missouri, and drove around. A friend of mine and I who lives in Kansas City, we drove around in a rent-a-van. And delivered them to all these little museums all throughout Kansas and Missouri. And they were allowed or asked to paint them any way they wanted, if they wanted to paint them, because they were primed and ready to paint. So, and it was one of the most fun periods of my life, because I got to, you know, if you go to 120 museums in 1 month, you're going to like six a day, and they always show you their most favorite collection and their most favorite things, and you get to see real quick, and then you drive on to another town, and they show you all of their. I mean, there was one museum in a town that only had 27 people, for instance. I mean, it was that interesting, and they had a museum. Can you imagine? 27 people and a museum. And so, like, this was a mineral museum. They weren't all historical society. This was a library. And this was the state capitol has a museum in it in Missouri. And I don't know why they accepted the gift, because they had. But they did. So this is all the places we delivered them to Kansas, and all the places we delivered them to Missouri. So there was a lot of, and then sometimes I would show up with, we'd show up with a model, and they'd have a newspaper photographer ready there, because it was the small towns were like, it was a big deal. Some artist from New York is coming to, I don't know why they thought it was such a big deal, but it tickled me, because they wanted to have an article in the newspaper about it, I guess, about their museum. And this is some of the, and then a couple of years later, I wrote a lot of the museums and asked if they had photos of how they'd used the models. And this is one. And some of them were like Indian trails. Some of them were like rivers. Some of them were, agricultural sections. Some just left white and put in the window or put in a, you know. One of my favorite ones is this. This woman is a very well-known mural painter in the town of Oswego, and she's very famous in the area, in that town, you know, and so she agreed to do one of them, so she did one. And then I think this is my favorite, the high school boy did one with the state flower and calling, you know, so it was really like a giving thing, giving things away, paid for by the Grand Arts people in Kansas City. So it was one of my favorite projects. So I gotta hurry. This is the 600 most popular female names and the 600 most popular male names printed and put in a frames. So each you had to buy 1,200. You'd have, you know, to get them all. And we've sold two groups of them already, and the National Gallery has taken one. Like, this is a gallery in Berlin, Germany, that put them all up on their walls. And it's the most, and what the weird thing is that it's about